Hi, I'm Josh Finley, director of the Texas Public Policy Foundation's new National Election Protection Project. And we're here to podcast with Jason Sneed from the Honest Elections Project. Jason, it's great to have you with us.
Josh, it's great to be here.
Wonderful. Well, first of all, I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about the Honest Elections Project.
Sure. So I'm the executive director of HEP. We are a national group that's dedicated to making it easier to vote and harder to cheat. So we're fighting for everyone's right to vote in free and fair elections. And we think that's an American right, not a right that only applies to one side or the other. So we work at the national level and at the state level to advance policies that secure elections, that bring transparency and accountability to the process, and build confidence in elections, which of course is the best possible way to encourage participation in the democratic process.
Absolutely. I love that tagline, easier to vote and harder to cheat. Election integrity means a lot of things to a lot of people, right? To some people it's litigation, some people it's legislation, some people it's campaign finance. How do you view election integrity and making it easier to vote and harder to cheat?
Well, I view election integrity through a very simple lens. Does a particular policy instill confidence and build trust in a system, or does it turn elections into a black box and a sloppy mess? And what we are always trying to look for are ways to build confidence through greater security, greater transparency, and ultimately clearer results in elections that are delivered more quickly than we have seen in recent election cycles. The reality is that we're at a very fragile moment in terms of trust in the democratic institutions of the country, the voting process and so forth. And that's a trust problem that exists on the left and the right. I mean, there isn't a single presidential election in this century that a Republican has won that Democrats have universally accepted, right? 2000, George Bush was selected, not elected, right? 2004, there were all these wild accusations about voting machines in Ohio flipping votes to secure the election for George Bush. Those were all stories that were peddled by the left. And then, of course, on the right, there's a great deal of skepticism, especially after so many voting laws were changed in the early part of 2020, ostensibly as a result of COVID, but really just because the left is always looking for a way to put a fat thumb on the scales in order to skew voting laws for itself. So I'm always looking at what ways we can improve transparency, improve trust, and build confidence in elections. And that's how I view election integrity.
I love that answer. And you talked about the last minute changes to the election process in 2020, right? I kind of want to dig into that a little bit because it seems to me like certain people use those process changes to a political advantage. Do you think that is the case? And can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, that's definitely the case. We knew, and this is why I started Honest Elections in the early part of 2020, we knew that was going to be the most litigious election year in history. Mm-hmm. And we knew that because for, you know, about a decade or so before that, the left had been working gradually to build up its capacity to bring lawsuits and was increasingly weaponizing the judiciary to advance its agenda. So a lot of times people have this misconception that you will roll into election day and the laws that are on the books that were written by your lawmakers are the rules governing elections. In actuality, very often it's rules that are imposed by courts as a result of very partisan litigation. So you can have the best election integrity laws in the country, but if they're gutted by a court at the last minute, it's not worth the paper that it's written on. So we knew that the left was going to be deploying that weapon that it had been building in the form of Mark Elias and his very well-funded partisan litigation operation. We didn't realize that COVID was going to give them an excuse to get started months earlier than they otherwise would have, right, and that they would take shots at literally any election law that they wanted to, that they felt inhibited them from doing their preferred GOTV type programs. So yes, they tried to change voting laws for partisan advantage all through 2020. They've done it in pretty much every state in the country since then. And we're talking about everything from basic voter identification laws to protections against vote trafficking to when ballots should be received by, right? A lot of states have laws that say ballots have to come in by the close of polls on election day. And there are plenty of lawsuits that were filed in 2020 to extend that to 3 days, 5 days, a week, 2 weeks beyond election day.
Right.
All of these changes are designed to skew election laws for partisan advantage. And there's an election industrial complex that the left has built up of nonprofit activists and lawyers and so forth that are all pushing in that direction.
You know, and a lot of people, I think, don't know about that cottage industry. I don't know if you can call it a cottage industry anymore, but that industry on the left that's popped up. Can you talk a little bit about that, maybe the history of it, and how you knew that this was going to be an issue in 2020 based on how the left had been gearing up to that election?
Yeah, you know, cottage industry, it's funny the way you say that. If you measured the amount of money that was going into this operation as like GDP, I think it would be a small country. That's how much money the left is pouring into this effort to weaponize election rules for its own advantage. And to give some sense of that perspective here, you know, what kind of numbers are we talking about? You know, Mark Elias is the leading lawyer on the left. He has access to virtually unlimited sums of money because his operation, you know, Democracy Docket, his operation is funded as part of a network of left-wing dark money managed by Arabelle Advisors. And this is a hub that controls on any given year somewhere between $1 and $2 billion to fund left-wing operations all across the board. So this isn't just elections, but literally any political fight that we are having, they have a finger or two or 10 in, and they have literally billions of dollars on the table to spend. So he can tap into an unlimited amount of money to try to change voting laws through the court process, and he can file lawsuits the way that you and I would file a press release. That's the scale that we're talking about here. Before the 2020 election, there were more than 200 lawsuits that were filed before November to change voting laws from the left. And they, as we said, were targeting, you know, voter identification, list maintenance laws, protections against vote trafficking. They were trying to force states to mail every single person on the rolls a ballot, and so much more. All of that was a process that was systematic, and it was designed to skew those voting laws. And it was all done on the fly while we were also dealing with a pandemic, while we were also dealing with plenty of other disruptions. And all of that was done for partisan advantage. You asked how we knew that was going to happen. The you know, before anyone gets any ideas, I didn't know COVID was going to happen, but we did have a pretty strong indication that this operation, this, you know, litigation engine that Mark Elias and others had been building up for the last few years was absolutely going to be deployed in 2020, because they had been using it for so long before the election, and each cycle was getting more litigious, more lawsuits were getting filed, there were more attempts pre and post election from the left to try to change voting laws and procedures or to challenge the results of elections. We knew that 2020 was an all-hands-on-deck moment for the left, and they were absolutely going to take this, you know, Death Star that they had had created, and they were going to try to use it. COVID gave them a pretext to go after any law and to do it in March and April of 2020 and then just keep doing it instead of waiting until a little later in the year.
Perfect. Can you give us a couple of examples of process changes, either through lawsuits or, you know, the Secretary of State making a change or something like that, that gave a partisan advantage to the left?
Well, you know, during the 2020 election, we actually saw this unusual thing happen where people sort of started to self-sort in not just in terms of who they voted for, but how they voted, right? The act of voting. And the left figured out that there were a lot more people on its side that wanted to vote by mail. So they started challenging rules that they thought were basically inhibiting them from being able to bring in every possible vote, right? So they went after, in a bunch of places, deadlines for ballots to come in by election day. They tried to extend those, and they got some, you know, positive rulings in Pennsylvania, for instance, which extended the ballot receipt deadline after election day so ballots could trickle in. In Minnesota, we saw a very collusive settlement that was reached between Mark Elias and the Democratic Secretary of State to change ballot procedures and to extend the ballot receipt deadline. HEP actually backed a lawsuit that went up to the Eighth Circuit and challenged that consent agreement that was reached between Elias and the Minnesota Secretary of State. We had a very strong ruling that indicated that it's legislatures, not right, bureaucrats, not the courts that are supposed to be writing our election laws, and we have to honor the laws that are on the books. So it was a very, very compelling ruling. But we saw some of those types of process changes. You saw some states decide under the threat of litigation that they were going to send everyone a mail ballot, right? So they essentially became all mail election states as a result of election litigation. And so now you can imagine you've got voter rolls that are bloated and inaccurate. Ballots are going out to every single person on those rolls, many of whom may be dead, many of whom may no longer live in that state or be qualified and eligible to vote in that state, but ballots are going out all the same. And then you're changing the rules around voter identification standards as well. So there were some states that had witness requirements that were stripped out as a result of litigation. So you're watching this gradual weakening of the security of the mail voting process. And then, of course, mail ballots can come in, you know, a week or 2 weeks in some places after Election Day. So it's a very, you know, it's a systemic kind of program that we saw where they looked and said, here's what we want an election system to look like, and we're going to use the courts to accomplish this, and we're going to do it all again under the guise of COVID.
So, Jason, you bring up a really good point talking about these changes, because it wasn't just that they made changes to loosen laws. It was, in my mind, it was that they made those changes without corresponding increases in transparency and security. So, for example, I was in Bucks County for the municipal election a couple of months ago, and I was talking to people about issues from 2020, and they said, you know, in that county, they went from having, you know, tens of thousands of mail-in votes to hundreds of thousands of mail-in votes because of some rules that Pennsylvania passed just prior to COVID. So when they described the elections office, I mean, they were describing just stacks of ballots everywhere without security around those ballots, without a proper way to track chain of custody on those ballots and things like that. So it seems to me like the left kind of decides that they want chaos in our elections sometimes, because if they were really looking for a secure process, they would change the process, but also increase transparency and security. Has that gotten better since 2020? Or what did you see in 2022?
Well, so after 2020, and after the chaos, as you put it, which I think is perfect, that we saw because of all of those rules changes, we saw a number of states pass laws that were designed to clean up elections, that learned from the experiences of the past, and ultimately made things better for voters, right? So we saw states like Georgia and Texas and Florida and Iowa and so many others pass laws. In fact, if you look at the Ballotpedia legislative tracker in 2022 and 2023, just in Republican trifecta states, 458 bills were enacted in Republican trifecta states touching on elections. So there has been a concerted burst of enthusiasm and initiative in Republican states, in red states, to improve the election process and try to prevent chaos from happening again. But the left is not giving up. We have to understand that. The left is doubling down, if anything else. They're always looking for ways to expand the margin of litigation. So they're trying to make the election system as muddy as possible, because if it's muddier, then that means that it's a lot easier for you to sue after an election to try to change the results. And let's not beat around the bush. That is what Mark Elias loves to do. If he has an opportunity to change the outcome of an election, he will take it, even if that means doing something as crazy as going to the, you know, Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives and just saying, refuse to seat the Republicans and seat the Democrat instead. So he will play that card. And a lot of the things that we see in terms of dialing down, leveling down on security, leveling down on transparency, it really is about making the system a little bit messier, a little bit more chaotic, and then hopefully the left, from their perspective, will take advantage of that chaos for their own purposes.
Well, I think that's exactly right. So let's try to look forward a little bit here. What can we expect in 2024 from the left? Yeah. If this is their playbook, and as you said, the fight's not over, right? In fact, the fight might even increase this election cycle.
Oh, I think the fight will, and I think it'll increase after this too. And that's maybe something we can come back to in a second. But I think that you're going to see a lot of litigation between now and November, and I think that you're going to see a lot of voting laws again, you know, try to get changed through the courts. We've already seen some stuff where, you know, Kansas has some very reasonable laws dealing with absentee ballot security and protections against vote trafficking. Those are being challenged. Signature requirements are being challenged. So the idea is now, you know, you would have mail ballots going out to individuals with absolutely no identification requirements whatsoever on those ballots, and partisan activists can go around door-to-door collecting votes from people. That is an excuse for fraud. That is a huge opening for voter intimidation, coercion, and disenfranchisement. That's why those laws exist, but the left is going after them. So I think that you're going to see more lawsuits that are about changing the process in order to boost the preferred left-wing GOTV operations. And that's, you know, kind of the nice, polite way of saying that. I also think that you're going to see kind of a PR blitz, right? Everything is going to be about democracy is on the line. And if you don't vote the way that the left wants, then you are anti-democracy itself, right? And that's something that we've seen for the last 3 years, really, right, with HR 1 and the attempt at a federal takeover of elections. The argument was constantly put forward. This is the only way to save democracy. If you don't back everything that the left likes, then you are, you know, a front man for fascism or whatever the particular phrase might be. I think we're going to see a lot of that. And I think that we're going to see a lot of attacks leveled against states that are looking at positive reforms this year. And they're going to say, this is another attempt at voter suppression. This is another attempt at restricting the vote. Even though, as recently as 2022, we saw firsthand what happens in a place like Georgia, where you have these laws enacted and you actually have high turnout, high confidence elections. So I think that you're going to see a combination of, you know, a PR blitz. I think you're going to see a lot of very friendly media outfits repeating these left-wing talking points. I think you're going to see litigation to change voting laws. It's going to be a potentially chaotic and very busy year for you and me.
I think so. I think we can count on that. So what can we do to protect this election process? Right? You said that that's how they're going to manipulate it. I think you're right in that when states pass laws, the left calls it voter suppression, but increase actually turns out because people have confidence in their vote and confidence in the process. What can we do to protect the election process this year and then going forward?
Yeah. Well, there's actually a few things that I think that states could do this year in terms of new laws that could be passed to help bring some of the security, some of the transparency that we've been talking about here today without complicating election administration. You know, this is something that, you know, you and I have talked about before. It's harder to make huge changes to election laws in an election year.
Right.
As the old saying goes, the road to hell is paved in good intentions, and we have the best intentions, but, you know, what can go wrong will go wrong. You always have to kind of thread that needle a little bit. But there are a few things that states can do this year and put into effect this year that would have positive impact on the 2024 election. The first would be to ban a new complicated voting scheme called ranked choice voting. This is something that's getting pushed into localities and states across the country. It is coming from the left. There are tens of millions of dollars that are being spent right now, and 10 or 12 states could face ballot measures to bring ranked choice voting to their states this year alone. But the way that these pro-RCV activists work, they will start at the local level. So they will go and get towns and cities to start using RCV to normalize it. The problem, of course, is that then you've got cities that are running elections under a vastly different set of rules than the rest of the state. State legislatures have an obligation to ensure consistency and clarity with their voting laws within their borders. And so banning ranked choice voting is a way that you can do that without disrupting election administration. You're actually bolstering it and making it easier for the people running elections and for the voters, because now the voters don't have a complicated ballot where some races are, you know, I've got to rank everybody, and some races are traditional plurality elections or whatever it might be. So ban ranked choice voting. That's one thing. Another is to ban private election funding, and not just the inflow of money from left-wing groups like we saw in 2020 with you know, Mark Zuckerberg's $400 million in Zuckbucks and how that got dispersed and so forth. Now we've got this new program that the same group that ran Zuckbucks in 2020 is running right now, called the U.S. Alliance for Election Excellence. That's active in numerous states, and they have set this up as a membership program. So they will recruit election offices to join a program that is run by left-wing groups like the Center for Tech and Civic Life and others. They will have these offices pay money as membership fees to join this program. Then those fees get converted into credits that can be used to purchase services exclusively from that network of left-wing organizations. So they target local offices, they surround them, they gather data from them, they develop plans to reshape the way that these offices function from the inside out, and then they use them as the hubs of a new kind of hub and spoke network to push alliance politics, which are all, you know, left-wing politics, of course, into election administration in whole states and whole regions. That's the game plan there. And we call this Zuckbucks 2.0. And it's designed from the jump to get around all the laws that states have been passing to shut down Zuckbucks 1.0. So we've been talking a lot about ways that the left is going to try to manipulate election laws and whatnot. Well, we always have to understand that the left is like water trying to get through a dam, right? You can plug one hole, but they will find another. So we always have to be thinking, what's the 2.0, 3.0, 4.0 version going to be? They've already pivoted from their 2020 Zuckbuck scheme. Now we need new laws to protect against the infusion of left-wing politics and the weaponization of the election administration system itself. And the third thing I think that people could do is to bring process audits. You know, this is a simple piece of legislation that can be enacted this year, that can be set up this year to ensure that after we vote in primaries and in the general in November, that election jurisdictions in a state are being process audited, which isn't about confirming winners. It's about making sure that the laws and procedures were actually being followed. And that was something that we saw in 2020, where election officials oftentimes deliberately ignored or flouted state laws. We saw this in Texas with an attempt to juice mail-in voting by just telling people to claim to be disabled, which is not what the state law is supposed to allow. So we need those process audits in place so that we can have that transparency piece of this and the accountability piece as well.
I love that. I want to unpack a couple of things that you said there. Going back to the Zuckbucks, why does that matter? Right, because if you describe it in the right way, you're talking about adding resources to an election process, right? But why does prohibiting Zuckbucks matter, or why does stopping that third party funding of our elections matter?
Well, because election administration is supposed to be neutral, it's supposed to be nonpartisan, and it's supposed to be accountable to the voters, right? When you bring in private election dollars, you are making those offices, at the very least, divide their loyalties between the taxpayers and the public that they serve and the millionaires and the billionaires and the special interests that are giving them sometimes millions of dollars in grant funding, right? So with the Alliance, we actually saw as they were recruiting offices, Greenwich, Connecticut, one of the wealthiest communities in the country, was targeted supposedly because, you know, they needed additional resources. Although we've done public records requests and we saw the officials in Greenwich actually send emails back to the Alliance saying, we're actually really well funded, thanks. They still got a huge grant that was equivalent to their entire annual budget, right? So the Alliance is pushing money into some of these offices, and that's creating a potential conflict of interest. In Michigan, Ottawa County was targeted by the Alliance as well, ended up withdrawing, and the head of their office put out a very powerful letter where he said, look, we're talking about taking grants from people that we don't know who they are. They could have vested interest in the outcome of the elections that they are now helping to pay for and helping to administer through this grant training coaching program that the Alliance for Election Excellence is. So this is a huge problem, and it's corrosive to public trust, especially when the program is being run by groups that feigned nonpartisanship, but are all plugged into the left-wing election industrial complex, right? They're all funded by the left. They are run by people who have deep ties to Democratic Party politics. And of course, their track record is 2020, where they sent $400 million disproportionately into jurisdictions that ended up voting for Joe Biden. And the money overwhelmingly went to GOTV operations that targeted what looks a lot like the Democratic voting base.
You know, you bring up such a good point there. When people think about Zuckbucks, I think a lot of times they talk about buying election infrastructure, right? Like with Racine, Wisconsin, right? That just, the court just said that they couldn't have the mobile voting vans that were funded by Zuckbucks.
First of all,
let's talk about how absurd it is that you can vote by van anywhere, right? It's not like we're going out buying hot dogs. People are questioning whether you should be able to buy a hot dog from a van, right? A food truck, let alone being able to conduct official government business in a van, right? But the thing that people don't talk about as much is the access that Zuckbucks buys, right? The ability to get data, the ability to be in conversations when you're talking about how to implement the election, how to implement a new process, how to change things. I think that access is something that we need to talk about a little bit more, because everybody assumes that our elections are nonpartisan, it's a government activity. But Zuckbucks showed us that that's just not the case anymore.
I think that's right. I mean, let's start from an assumption that I think is a valid one, which is that most of the time, elections officials are good people trying to do right by their constituents. But that makes it, you know, kind of all the more enticing when a nominally nonpartisan group who these folks don't know from Adam comes in and says, hey, we want to help. We want to give you resources. We want to give you training. We want to invite you to fancy conferences and things like that. A lot of times these election officials just don't know who they're getting in bed with, right? So that's why my group and others have done so much work on this issue, just trying to educate these folks so that they understand when you're approached by the alliance, it would be best if you just steer clear of them, because you don't want to risk public confidence in you and in your office and in the trust that you have earned with your community. But the alliance is very insidious, and it is designed to push influence and politics into election offices and to leverage the access and the relationships that CTCL and its partners are building in order to accomplish that goal. You know, Zuckbucks, we focus on the money, right? And so many states passed laws to ban the inflow of money. But the money was never the end. The money was the means. The end was influence. The end was changing election administration from the inside out, influencing the way government offices run for the benefit of the left. And that's why they so quickly pivoted to this new program to get around the bans that were being put into place and to allow them to continue to influence peddle within the, you know, confines of election administration. But you're absolutely right. The access is the key here. That's what they want. That's what they're working with the alliance to get. And that's why it's so important that states shut this down, because this is not a good government group. A good government group would not look at a law in Georgia that says no private election funding and then figure out a loophole that lets them send $2 million in private election funding into DeKalb County. A good government group would not invite Brunswick County, North Carolina, to join its program. And then when the county commissioners in Brunswick vote unanimously calling on their county board of elections to withdraw from this partisan program, then, you know, Brunswick County just says, well, I'm going to stay in. Thanks. They wouldn't be pushing that kind of thing either. So this is not a good government group. They are not your friends. And it is so important. In fact, I would argue that legislatures have a duty to their citizens to ensure that elections are neutral and nonpartisan. And the best thing you can do is to shut down private election funding and Zuckbucks 2.0.
So let's talk a little bit about these process audits that you brought up. It seems to me like elections, we think about them too often as partisan activities, right? Campaigning should be partisan. Obviously, we have parties fighting over who wins. But the parts of elections that we're fighting about right now are really just a counting exercise for the most part. And so it seems like a process audit is something that every county out there, every jurisdiction would want to get involved with, to be able to tell their citizens, hey, we're using best practices. Look at our models. We're transparent. You can see what we're doing. Why are these process audits so important?
Well, these process audits are a way to build trust in elections by showing people that, hey, your local office passed an audit. It followed election laws. It followed procedures appropriately, or it didn't, right? And look, a lot of times when mistakes are made, that's all they are. They're mistakes. They are errors. People are human and fallible, right? Most of the time, it's not nefarious. Sometimes it is, and there's absolutely accountability whether an error is made or it's deliberate, right? But process audits are a way for us to kind of see into election offices and help show the public what is actually going on. And most of the time, you're going to find out that law was actually adhered to, that the process worked pretty well. And when there are issues that are identified, then we can use those to inform another round of election reforms that will, you know, take the slack out of the system even more, right? But this is about instilling confidence in the system. Now, a lot of times there's an instinctive reaction on the part of government officials, no matter what, you know, your particular bureaucracy might be, it's not just election officials, to say, I want to kind of protect myself from the public. The public will be angry. They might take something out of context. So we're going to go the opposite direction of transparency. We're going to go for opacity. But sunshine is the best disinfectant. It's also the best way to show people you've got nothing to hide. And it's a great way to build trust in the system, to let people see the inner workings of your office. So I'm always very pro-transparency. Process audits are a way of making sure that we can actually see what's going on in election offices.
You know, I used to have a statement up on a board in one of my offices. You can find a conspiracy anywhere if you don't understand how things work. I think that's the key to process audits, right? Even better if we can do them before the election, but show people what we're doing, how we're counting your votes, and why this should work. So Jason, we're about out of time here. What do we have to look forward to post-2024? I know a lot of people, they put a deadline on politics. It's the next presidential election. But the fight for election integrity is not going to end at 2024. That's a feeling I've got. What do we need to look forward to in the future?
Well, I think that we need to understand that the left is in this to win it. They want to accomplish generational change, and that's the timetable that they're thinking on. So they're not just thinking about winning the next presidential election or the next midterm. They're thinking about how do we push politics to the left, and how do we make sure that in 20 years, America is a left-of-center country at best, right? They would be happy to go further if they could. So we as conservatives need to understand that the deadline, no matter what happens in November, the deadline for this fight is not November of 2024. Let's assume for a second that conservatives do very well and do very well on election night in November. My great fear is that then people think the election integrity fight is over. And what keeps me up at night most is thinking 10 years down the road, when we're dealing with constitutional amendments to enfranchise felons and non-citizens and 16-year-olds to vote, which is all happening right now in pockets of the country, when that becomes a national movement and the right has spent the last 10 years, you know, from our perspective right here, right now, the next 10 years, sitting that fight out while the left continues to gear up for more and more election changes. We always have to be on duty, ready to work to promote election integrity and to ensure that we have elections that we can have confidence in. So I think that looking forward, we're going to continue to see pushes for things like ranked choice voting. We're going to continue to look at new rounds of private election funding. Like Buck 3.0 and 4.0 will be absolutely waiting around the corner. New runs at voter identification laws, making it harder to clean up voter rolls, enfranchising non-citizens, lowering the voting age. All of these things are priorities of the left. And then, of course, the big one, which we always had to be cognizant of, from here on out, we are only one election away from the left having the political power in Washington to blow up the Senate filibuster and pass a federal election takeover, and without the filibuster, pack the Supreme Court, add a few more states. All sorts of things could happen at that point too. So we always have to be mindful of the importance of election integrity, and we have to start thinking generationally as well. We need our grassroots, we need conservative donors, we need the activist community, we need the think tanks, everyone to understand this is a major issue, and it's worth investing our resources in for the long haul fight. It's not a sprint, it's a marathon. But the good news is, it's a fight that conservatives can win. And I always tout this fact, we do a lot of polling. Voter identification laws, photo ID requirements are more popular today than they were in 2021, despite 2 years of a liberal blitz trying to convince us that voter ID laws are racist. We have, as conservatives, the common sense solutions to the problems of elections, and they're the solutions that Americans across the board, left and right, actually want to see. So we can win this fight. We just have to make sure that we're committed to the long haul. And if we are, then I think that we'll be in a much better position 10 years from now than we certainly were in 2020.
Well, that strategic vision is so important, right? Having that long-term vision. We saw the Democrats capitalize on that before 2020. We need to make sure that that doesn't happen again. And we're thankful for you and groups like yours for having that long-term vision. Jason, any final thoughts before we wrap up here? What do the people need to do to protect our elections in 2024?
Well, I think that the number one thing is to vote. Make sure that you turn out and that you vote and you make your voice heard. That's going to be the number one most important thing I think that any American can do this year. But stay educated on this. Make sure that you're engaged. Go be a poll worker if you have the opportunity to do that. We always need good people working the polls and making sure that we have a smooth and well-run election system. But stay engaged and talk to your neighbors about things that are coming down the pike for us. Ranked choice voting, Zuck Bucks, and so much more. There's a lot to do, but I think that people have a great deal that they can do to improve election integrity.
Thank you for that message of hope. Let's end on a note of confidence for the people.
No.
Jason Sneed with the Honest Elections Project, thank you for joining us. I'm Josh Finlay with the Texas Public Policy Foundation's National Election Protection Project. Thank you, and have a good afternoon.